you.
Good morning. My name's Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February 13th, 1989. My home group is the Camby Saturday morning breakfast meeting. There are a few people that have attended that meeting here. But it is not in Camby, it is in Oregon City at a place called the Wild Hair Saloon. So we do have a meeting in a saloon, but there is breakfast there. My sponsor is Mike Kay, formerly, or AKA, always known as Mongo. And that can tell you a little bit about my spirituality. And he has a sponsor, and I have a grand sponsor. And I've known that grand sponsor for close to 28 years. I like to start by reading something. I'm not going to get into a whole lot about my drinking. This is what I'm going to try to do. It says, tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. Like I said, I'm not going to get a whole lot into my drinking. I am going to tell you what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, though. It wasn't my second divorce that brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that played a part in it. Back in November of 87, my soon-to-be second ex-wife left to go to New Mexico to live with her dad, and she took our then about almost 1-year-old son with her. And I had this brilliant idea that I'm going to I was going to file for divorce, and then I'm going to file for custody, and then I'm going to file to make sure that the child gets returned back to Oregon. And also, I thought maybe it'd look good for a judge if I got involved in some alcohol and drug treatment. There's some laughers. People have done that before themselves. So their laughter tells about how well it worked for me. And I entered an outpatient program in Milwaukee, Oregon, through Providence Hospital called the Options Program. And they wanted me to get one of these things called a big book, but I didn't. They wanted me to go to meetings, but I didn't. They mentioned something, I think, about a sponsor, but I didn't hear it. And because I hadn't done that stuff, I was just going through the motions, because I did not want to stop drinking. But I had to for a little bit, because I wanted to please a judge at that court hearing. I was supposed to go to court on January 25th of 1988, but I got sidetracked a little. I hadn't had a job for a number of years, and I thought it would look good, too, if I had a job, so I got a job. And I was working at this place in Camby that made diving boards, and I got off work at noon. I wasn't living in Camby at the time, but I stopped off at my mother's house to see how she was doing. And my plan was to head home to Gladstone, where I was living, rent a couple videos, and get ready to go to court on Monday the 25th to try to get custody of my then 1-year-old son. I know there's a few of you who are familiar with the Camby area, but if you're not, as you're leaving Camby going down 99E towards Gladstone and Oregon City, if you're familiar with Camby, you know on the right-hand side there's a Fred Meyer's. Back in 1988, that Fred Meyer's wasn't there, but there was a tavern in that area called the Rip City Pub. I saw the cars and pickups of people that I worked with in that parking lot, and I decided, you know, I haven't really had a drink in about 45 days. I hadn't read the doctor's opinion. I hadn't read more about alcoholism. I didn't know nothing about the phenomenon of craving. I didn't know about the delusional thinking that goes on in a person's mind of my type. So I pulled into that tavern with the idea, the plan of having two beers. You know that everybody else has had the two-beer limit put on themselves, I see. Well, when I walked into the tavern, the people that I worked with, they were all sitting at a table. The table was full, but it was right next to the bar. So I sat up on the bar stool, and I earned myself a small pitcher. Now, I know many of you know that that's a little bit more than that original two-beer limit. But, you know, with my magical, mystical mind, I told myself that, you know, I normally would have got a large pitcher. And then this thing happened. Someone I worked with bought around, and another small pitcher was put in front of me. I used to think peer pressure only affected people grade school, high school. It probably does. But I'm an alcoholic, and I got this phenomenon of craving. So, yeah, I drank that one. And then someone else bought around. There was another one, and another round got bought. And I remember buying around. The last thing I remember from the tavern was I racked the balls on the pool table to start a game of three ball. The next thing I remember is, I can't tell you I knew where I was, but I remember seeing the faces of two people. I knew who they were, and they told me that I was in Emmanuel Hospital, and it was my mother and my sister. And my mother had told me that I had been involved in a car crash, or that three people had died. I was told by doctors there, the first, I was lucky to be alive, and you know, that sort of stuff. And on April 4th, I was arrested and charged with three counts of first-degree manslaughter and taken to Clackamas County Jail, also known as Clackatraz, to those familiar. And you know, when I went in there, I ended up pleading guilty, so there was no trial, but you're there for a while, and there was a plea bargain, and I'm going to be going before a judge. And I had another brilliant idea. They had these people that were coming in from the outside. They call it H&I. I didn't know that that's what it was then, but they were bringing in a meeting. And I thought, thinking man that I am, you know, it might look good to that judge, even though there's a sentence already agreed upon, that maybe he'll go light on me if he finds out that I'm going to these AA meetings. Well, I don't remember a thing about that meeting. All I remember is they had this corny little phrase. I remember that. It was this thing called live life on life's terms. And what I've got to tell you, where I was at that time and where my thinking was before that and to that day was, that did not seem too appealing to me. Well, on August 16th, I was sentenced to 60 years with a 9-year minimum, and God knows I deserve more time for the crime that I committed than 60 years with a 9-year minimum. On August 23rd, I was taken to the Oregon State Penitentiary. And under the sentencing guidelines that I was under, after you were there for a year, and that time started on April 4th, you get to go before the parole board with the hope that they might cut the sentence down and run them shorter or things like that. And, you know, I, thinking man, like I said I am, I had this brilliant idea. I heard about this meeting inside the penitentiary called the Mill Creek Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, you know, it might look good to the parole board if I go to that meeting and they find out that I go to that meeting. And on February 13th, 1989, I walked into the Mill Creek Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a man from the outside that came in. His name was Chicago John. And he shared his experience, strength, and hope, because he had done time in Marion, Illinois for a manslaughter charge or something like that. And his story touched me, and it hit home. And he had this corny, philosophical, old-age saying, you can't unring the bell, but you never have to ring it again. And for some reason, that hit. It hit home. And because of Chicago John, on February 13th, 1989, I admitted to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. Another thing happened to me at that meeting. There was a bunch of guys in blue. They came up to me. They held out their hand. They shook it. They welcomed me there. And that Alcoholics Anonymous stuff, I don't really know a whole lot about what that means at this time. But they were even coming up to me on the yard and asking how I'm doing, and they're checking in with me. And they're making sure I'm doing the stuff I need to be doing. And they were teaching me about these steps. And because of these men in blue, I came to believe that a higher power, greater than myself, could restore me to sanity. And my thinking's opened up a little more then, because see, what's happened to me was then it got to that third step. I had to make a decision. And I had a previous idea of what a God was because I went to church quite a bit when I was younger. So I had this belief. But what's come to me now is I've learned through listening to a guy named Tom I, in some speaker tapes recently, how it doesn't say believe in, it says believe that. Because see, the belief I had didn't fit my scenario because there was no way I could make that decision. Because I could no way believe in my life how I could be able to live. Because you see, what I had done just before you get to Oregon City, there's a place called a Kanema district, and there's a curve there, and I went around that curve at 70 miles an hour and ran head-on into a car carrying Scott, his wife Trudy, and two daughters, Amy and Jessica. Scott, the driver, lived. His wife and two daughters died. And I could not see for the life of me how there could be a God that would allow that to happen. So in not knowing a whole lot about it, I chose that little acronym that doesn't really make sense to me now, group of drunks, to be my higher power. So I made them the higher power. But what I know today is no human power can restore me or relieve me of my alcoholism, but God could and would if he were sought. And that's where I got to know that when it says in step two, it says, can. That God came to believe that a higher power came to, get up here and go brain dead. That's nice. That a higher power could. Now I have to believe in that higher power for that to happen. I have that faith for that to happen. And I really didn't have that then. But I chose that group of drunks. And then that led me to my fourth step. And I did the fourth step not as good as Jason did his. So if you want to know how to do a fourth step, you can either ask Jason, you know, and he can tell you how to do it right. But I did the columns. I did the best I can. And I did my fifth step with a lady that was an art therapist inside the walls. And her name was Kate McDonald. Kay McDonald. And when we got to that thing, that part of selfishness, when I was selfish about myself and what I had done to those children and how it affected me. But then part of it, I was resentful for me. And I was leaving out about a lot about totally what I had done. And I had that resentment about me, and she did a clarification for me. She told me to not look at me killing that mother and two children, but that they died for me, and there's a spiritual principle in some places about that. And how she explained it to me was that if Jeff was standing by a bus stop, and he's waiting for a bus, and this car's, and he's talking to somebody out, his back's turned to the oncoming traffic, and I go out there and I see this car coming towards him, and I push Jeff out of the way, and in doing so, I save his life. That Jeff looking down, there'd be kind of an honor in his death. And there'd be a purpose and a meaning behind his death. And he would probably be okay with that. I mean, if I die in that, I would be okay with that. But if Jeff had been like Ron would have been, dusting him off, cursing, not knowing that somebody had just saved my life, not even thinking about that, and stumbled into a bar, that I would probably be pretty pissed off looking down. And I can't describe what feeling that was or what happened. I got these things called goosebumps, and it felt like it was either the hand of God or the hand of three little angels reaching down and touching me, saying, it's okay to go forward, clean up, move forward. And I don't know if that was the time, I believe it was that time when I really experienced what that third step prayer talks about, that freedom of the bondage of self, because that bondage that always kept me from that connection with that God, that higher power, was me. My thoughts about what it should be like. There was a prayer said for me today, and it said, it was part of that set-aside prayer. God, let Ron forget about all his thoughts about you, about himself, and about this program so that he can be more open to learn more about and say what God wants me to say. So that's my mission from here on out, and that's what I'm going to be talking about, because I don't really like to talk about the drinking, but I do want to talk to you about this thing called a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter what. That's the theme, no matter what. I ended up doing the steps. I ended up being put into a thing called service work. Back when I was there, I was given a position because they wouldn't allow the coins that come in. They wouldn't allow us to have those because they were, you could make them into an escape device, they said. So I was the certificate guy. So when people would come in from the outside, I would get their sobriety date and I'd write it down. If a new man came in, I'd get his sobriety date and I'd write it down. And that next meeting, I would have a 30-day, a 60-day, a 90-day certificate. And if someone like Alan, who came in there from the outside, or even Timmy, I would have a certificate for them when they came in. Whether they showed up or not, I would have a certificate, and it made a commitment. And I got involved in a lot of other things. I ended up getting a four-year degree while I was there. I was in the last graduating class of a four-year degree program inside the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I was involved in everything I could be. After I got that four-year degree, I ended up teaching adult basic education to men in there that were trying to get their GED. And what I learned from these men in blue, especially this guy here, he's still in there. At age 21, he kills somebody in a blackout, doesn't know why he's there, but he's a grateful alcoholic. There's another guy who died in there, Harry Hart. He had a life sentence in Nebraska that he was taken off death row when they shut that off, and he was sent to Oregon to finish that sentence there, then he was going back to Nebraska to finish. He died in there. But what those men in blue taught me was no matter what you've done, who you are, where you're at, there's a purpose and there's a meaning for you at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess I can put a no matter what behind that too, because there is a purpose and a meaning for you. You don't know what that meaning is, and that's probably a good thing, because that keeps, it kept me out of the way of a lot of getting right things done. And that's God's job, not mine. Well, under the sentencing guidelines I was under, after you're there for 3 years, you're able to go before the parole board to try to get a 7-month time cut. I'm now at the 6-year mark, and I'm going there to try to get a 7-month time cut. And Scott, the driver, he was not at that parole hearing. He had been to the others with his family. Scott had since remarried, and he was wanting to move on and set that behind him, however he could, the best he could. But Trudy's mother and father came to that parole board hearing, and the way the parole board hearing worked back then, now they've got videos, so there was a table, one of those, with three chairs, and there was three parole board officers sitting at that table, and then there was that picket court fence type thing, and then there was another table, and I was sitting where Holly was sitting in that table looking at those three parole board members, and I'm not allowed to look back, and they led Trudy's mother, Helen, and father, Ken, into the the meeting, and they were sitting behind me. And I didn't say anything, because they had this glowing report by the case manager I had inside the walls saying that I had done more to rehabilitate myself than anybody that had seen on his caseload. And that's because of service work that these guys taught me. Because that doing the adult education teaching, that's service work. They said it's not just inside the meeting, it's outside the meeting carrying a message. So I had this glowing report, so I didn't say anything. And then they asked if the victim's family would like to speak. And Helen said that she would like to read a letter. And that letter was telling what it was like to lose a daughter and two grandchildren, and how she could no longer color with those grandchildren or have them sit on their lap and eat popcorn, on her lap and eat popcorn and watch movies, and all those things that she enjoyed. And she talked about how that was, and at that time I'm thinking, we don't need to go on any further. I don't need no time cut. We can just stop right here. I don't need it. And then Trudy's mother, Helen, asked if she could read a letter from her younger sister, from Trudy's younger sister. And she was out allowed to read that letter, and that was about her sister, Tracy, saying goodbye to her older sister. And how that impacted her. She dropped out of college because of what happened. She had just started. She shared about that, and as that's being said, I'm thinking, I just wish I could slither out of there and go back to my cell, and if they want to give me more time, I'm okay with that, because God knows I deserve more time than I was given. And then what happened is they led Helen and Ken out, and they were placed in a room with a door shut that was about from me to the end of those tables, and I was asked to go out and sit down in a chair. And there was a parole officer in there while they made their decision on what they were going to do. And at that time, as I'm sitting in that chair, that door opens and Helen and Ken are standing in the doorway. And Helen asked if she could talk to me. And I looked at her and I looked at the guard and I said, it's okay if it's okay with you. And he said, yeah, it's okay, but lady, you got to stay in that doorway. Mr. Hansen, you got to stay in that chair, and he got over in between just in case. And this is when I learned about the ninth step. Helen said to me that she was sorry for coming down so hard on me at that parole board hearing, and that if I got a time cut, she would be supportive because she knew I had a son, and she knew that I had been doing what I was supposed to do. And at that time, she made me ask her to promise her one thing. And she asked me to promise her that I would never drink and drive again. And in my zeal, I made a promise to her that I know now that I never should have made. I told her I would never drink again. And that means step one no longer applies because of that promise. So I need each and every one of you, whether I just met you, whether you're a newcomer, whoever you are, that you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that you keep these meetings going and you keep these things happening, because I can't make this on my own. There's no way. I need that higher power. That higher power speaks to me through each and every one of you. No matter what your story is, it speaks to me. And what I know today is I carry two coins in my pocket. One's a 30-year coin and one's a 24-hour coin. And when the crap hits the fan, that 30-year coin ain't going to do me any good, but that 24-hour coin's going to define the rest of my life. And the only way it can do that is if I'm connected to each and every one of you in some way or some form. And then I told her that I'd meant to write her. I had wanted to write her, but that I, with the legal aspects, that I wasn't able to, and I couldn't. And she said she understood. She understood. So we go back into the parole board hearing. I'm let in, and then they're let in, and Helen asked the parole board if she could say something. And at that time, she asked the parole board if it would be okay if I write her a letter. And they said, yes, it would be okay as long as it was okay with her. A miracle happened that day. Besides that, I gotta believe it was on a Tuesday, that parole board hearing. Because on Tuesday, in the education floor of the Oregon State Penitentiary, there was a meeting of the Mill Creek Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I shared what had happened with these men in blue at that parole board hearing. And what they said was, when you write that letter, you thank her for us too. So I wrote the letter. And you know, I know why I brought it up there, partly because it was a miracle for me, and partly because I knew that I can't hold myself accountable, but you people can. You can help me stay accountable. And I made a promise to them that I would do that, so I wrote the letter. I got out of prison on March 20th of 1996. It was a Wednesday. And what I recommend to people if they get off parole or they get out of jail or not off, if they're on, gotta go see your parole officer, that you go do it, because that's generally what they want you to do, right, Jason, when you first get out? So I went to see my parole officer. What I've got to tell you is my mom picked me up and she drove me there. I probably still would have made it there because AA had caught hold in my life. And a miracle happened to me while I was visiting that parole officer. My parole officer was not there. But there was a parole officer filling in for him. His name's Jerry LaBash. And he looked over my paperwork, and the last 17 months of my sentence was at the Oregon State Hospital in a drug and alcohol treatment program called Cornerstone that's no longer in existence. And they had me fill out this aftercare plan, and I was hooked up with people who were coming in from the outside. I had a temporary sponsor. His name's Jim Wolf. He's since passed away. He was my temporary sponsor because he was coming in there too, to the state hospital, and I thank you people for doing H&I. Never be able to repay you guys for doing that. And I had 90 meetings in 90 days. Where that stuff come from, I don't know, because it should be, you know, how many days a week did you drink? How many days every day? How many days a year? Every day. I guess I should have been doing that instead of that 99 days, but that's treatment lingo. So I had signed up for that. I had meetings I'm going to. I had a bus ticket, and I got rides how I'm getting there. And Jerry LaBash looked over my stuff, and he said, you know, it looks like you've got things under control here. Would you mind thinking about talking to my wife, Linda? She was also one of those POs. He said, she's on the board of the Clackamas County DUI Victims Impact Panels. And I said, well, I'll think about it. I'm still in a fog. I just got out, you know, not more than 4 hours ago. And Wednesday, what I recollect now is, because I used to thought it was later that day, but now I know it was Thursday, that I had a mental health appointment, which was part of my parole plan, to see if I needed more treatment. And that lady looked over, her name was Terry Patton, and I walked into her office to see what I needed to do for her assessment, and I took her that aftercare plan with all the stuff I'm doing, and she said, you know, all you need to do is do what they say. She didn't say every treatment program's aftercare plan is go to 12-step meetings, but in a sense, that's what she said. She said, you're okay. But if you want to get your driver's license back, you got to sign up for a class. So I signed up for the class. As I'm walking out the door, she goes, oh, by the way, Ron, would you be interested in speaking at DUI victims impact panels? And I said, well, you're the second person that's asked me that. I'll think about it. So now I went from in a fog to I'll do some thinking, and you know what happens with my thinking. Well, that was on a Thursday night, and Thursday night, and back then in the Canby City Hall, they have a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe Alan was in that meeting when I got out. And there was, in this meeting here, you'll see this woman, Trish. She was married to a guy named Frosty, and she was bringing people in. One of the things that I've got to say is, this is her daughter. No, there's her daughter. That's her daughter's friend. This is a lady, this lady here, that lady right there. If you go back to where Timar tapes here, you'll see Luana. That's her. That's her and her husband, Dennis, who passed away. And give her a hug for me when you see her. I'm going to do it again. And the reason I brought that up is because this is what the Mill Creek Group of Alcoholics Anonymous looked like when I first got there. When she started bringing her daughters and their friends in, we went to, there was 112 people put on the list to try to get into a meeting that would only hold, in the visiting room that would only hold 71. Progress, not, promotion, how's that thing go? It has nothing to do with going in to hook up. Let's put it that way. So just for your knowledge. And so I go to that meeting, and I'm sitting behind Trish and Frosty or Dave, and they're kind of surprised to see me when I come in. I'm sitting behind them, and they start the meeting, and they ask, is anybody here from out of town? And I raised my hand, and I said, yes, I just moved here from Salem. And they started passing around a sheet and with people's names and phone numbers on it, and they said, welcome. They said, welcome. And then Frosty, they asked him to speak once the meeting started, and he kind of long-winded, but when he was through, he said, I'd like to give the remainder of my time to a friend I haven't seen for a while, Ron. And at that time, I got a lot more honest, and I told him I just got out of the penitentiary. This is my second meeting in 2 days. And instead of saying, welcome, they said, welcome home. Welcome home. So if you're new here, look around. Welcome home. You've got a great big family here that's willing to do whatever they can for you, as long as you reach out and as long as you accept that hand that reaches out. They will save your life. So welcome home. After that meeting, I'm out in the parking lot and talking with Frosty and a couple other people that I hadn't seen for a while, and Frosty kind of takes me to the side and he says, hey, Ron, would you be interested in speaking at DUI Victims Impact Panels? So I don't know how your higher power works, but you see, I've got three little angels up there that are convincing me, and when I got asked, I said yes. So I've been speaking at DUI Victims Impact Panels in Clackamas County since November of 96, and in Multnomah County since February or March of 97, and it's gone farther than that now. There's some other streets where I've been behind the wheel with a terrible driver, and I'm not going to get into that to go up the gorge. But you know who I'm talking about. They know. So, you know, I considered that a service work position, you know, doing that, speaking at those panels. Well, in about 9 years ago, I was thinking, you know, I've been doing that for a while. I need to cut out one of those panels because it's too much. I know I don't look like I'm getting older, but I am. And I'm coming up with all sorts of excuses why I shouldn't, and I should cut out the Multnomah panel. It's now done at Emmanuel Hospital where they took me after that crash. And one of the ladies, she was running it there. She was on a helicopter that got sent back because of the deaths. And I'm doing that panel, and I'm thinking about letting them know that I'm going to, you know, slow down a little and take a little relaxation. You know, we'll see how long people stay doing service work here, but my higher power had something different in mind. Before I was able to do that, a letter came in the mail, and it was from trauma nurse, Emmanuel Hospital Trauma Nurses Talk Tough, and I thought, oh, it's probably Joan. She's going to be stopping. She's talking about retiring. And I opened it, and I got this letter. It's dated June 3rd, 2010. To the panel that spoke on May 27th, 2010, this is a very difficult letter for me to write. In 1988, my dearest friend since grade school and her two young daughters were killed by a drunk driver near Oregon City. The drunk driver survived the crash. Besides coping with emotions surrounding the death of my best friend, intense anger and depression, I had to teach my five-year-old son and his younger brother about death and why I couldn't have a play date with their friend Jessica anymore. Those were very sad times. In April of this year, my 25-year-old son was arrested for drunk driving. This was heartbreaking to me. Obviously, he was raised with firsthand knowledge of how devastating drinking and driving can be. He knew better. On the evening of May 27th, 2010, my son attended an alcohol diversion class. I believe it changed his life. He called me after the class and told me of the events that happened in the class. An EMT talked about a call he responded to in Clackamas County. My son said that as the EMT story unfolded, he felt that he recognized the event. But when the next person on the panel spoke, explaining that he was the drunk driver that caused the crash that the EMT responded to, my son realized that this was the story of the death of his mother's friend, Trudy, and his brother's playmates, Jessica and Amy. My son had been slipping away for many months, difficult to reach, impossible to reason with. Everything he had been taught had been discarded, and he was making his own way. But at the night of the class, he had come full circle. The narratives of the EMT, I hate it when gratitude comes out my nose. Of the EMT and the drunk driver, coupled with my son's personal knowledge of his tragedy, impacted him more than any lecture, speech, or sermon I could have delivered. During the phone call to me that night, he was truly saddened and humiliated by his choice to drink and drive. I know it must be difficult for the panel to regularly talk about a tragic professional or personal experience. I don't know if you ever get any feedback, but I'd like to give you mine. On May 27th, 2010, your story greatly impacted my family, probably saving my son's life and possibly others. I know it has changed my son, and I am sure that he will recount this odd series of events with his peers in the process. Will hopefully educate them of the perils of drinking and driving. I know your work will be extended beyond the one to touch the many. I am thankful for your work on the panel and hope that you will use this message to remind yourself that your time, energy, and self-sacrifice is recognized and worth it. You are making a difference. I guess you realize that I'm still speaking at those panels. Another miracle about that part of that letter is I speak, they have three DUI impact panels a month in Multnomah County. I only speak at one of them. I got to believe that higher power, those three little angels, orchestrated that odd series of events so that I could be doing what God wants me to do, not what Ron wants me to do. You know, as I was reading that letter, my wife looked over at me at the table, and she goes, "It must be bad news," and I shook my head no, and I handed her the letter, because getting that letter at that time was something that I needed to hear. It says, we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale you have gone, you will see how your experience can benefit others. We will lose interest in our selfish things, like wanting to give up doing things that God wants you to. And we will gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. I want to talk a little bit about fear of people and economic insecurity before I go on. But before I do that, if I read down farther, there's a thing in there that says sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. On March 9th of 2016, I believe it was. Yes, it was. 2016, I'm at a DUI victims impact panel in Clackamas County. And what happens at those panels is afterwards people will come up, they might give us a hug, they'll thank us, they'll shake our hands, they'll tell us, you know, that we've helped them, and, you know, and then there's people who just go out and get their certificates. I've got a friend, Larry, who's here. He wasn't there at that one, but he works there as a volunteer at those in Clackamas County. And all of a sudden at the end, and my talk there is not my AA talk. It's what I believe to be how I impacted Scott, the driver who lived. And Scott also had at that time a two-year-old son, Timmy, who was not in the car. They were coming home from having dinner at Grandma and Grandpa's. And how I believe it impacted him, and I can't fathom the impact what I had done to them. And I don't have enough time to go into all that. You can come to a victims panel if you want to hear it. And this lady about this tall comes up, and she stands in front of me. And she says, my name's Tracy. And I say, I know, and it took her a little by surprise. And because a judge I know, his son was going to school with Tracy. And she had asked about how I was doing and what was going on. And if I'm still doing those impact panels, so she showed up. And what she did standing in front of me is she validated every thought I had about how much damage I did to that little young boy from two on. But she says he's doing much better on, and she told me the whole hard truth of how it impacted them. And what she told me is what happened in that first letter, that she had dropped out of college. Here, 28 years later, she just completed college. And then she took and she put her arms around me. But she put her head in my chest. And according to a different judge, the Multnomah County judge that does the panels, I think he was supposed to be here today, I don't know. His wife and him generally come. That she sobbed in my chest for over 2 minutes, and I was able to whisper in her ear how sorry I was. And then she let go, and she thanked me for continuing to speak at those DUI victims impact panels. And what I know to be true today is that if I had to cut out that Multnomah one, it wouldn't have been long before I would have cut out that Clackamas one. That never would have happened. That never would have happened. I'm so grateful for those angels. I'm so grateful for that guy in Alcoholics Anonymous asking me to speak. Because, you know, if a PO asks you to do something, it's, oh, I'll think about it. If a mental health person asks you, well, what the heck do they know? But if somebody out of Alcoholics Anonymous asks you, there's a yes coming. There's a yes coming. That fear of people. There was a different judge that was at that meeting at Canby. He gave Alan the key to get in there when Alan was still on probation. Oops, sorry, Alan. Not talking. But I didn't say his last name. And he's smiling, and he's giving me some sort of thing. And he comes up to me after the meeting, and some judge is wanting to give me a hug. And I really didn't want a hug from a judge, but I accepted the hug from the judge. And then he gave me a card saying, if you ever need a ride to a meeting or if you need somebody to talk, here's my card, here's my home address, here's the law office that he's working in. And he says, if you call my law office, tell him it's an AA call and I'll get right back to you. What he was saying is, if you're a regular person needing to talk to your attorney, they won't probably get right back to you. That's what I get out of that. But there is this responsibility statement that goes with AA. And his secretary agrees to that. She goes, yep. Well, I'm out 3 weeks or so, and I hear about this guy who's celebrating a birthday, and I want to go to the birthday meeting in Beaver Creek. They don't have buses that go to Beaver Creek, so I call that judge, and I ask him for a ride. And he takes me to that birthday meeting, the birthday meeting of Chicago John. And I got to thank him for how he had impacted me. And you know what he said to me? Ron, you can't unring the bell, but you never can have to ring it again. That goes to economic insecurity. When I got out of prison, I needed a job. And I didn't have a whole lot of great qualifications at that time. But there was a guy that was coming out from the outside who was part of a mentor program. He owned 4 McDonald's in the Gresham area. And he said when I get out, he'd give me a job. And I went to look him up with the guy that brought him in there, and he said he'd hire me, but that's two-hour bus ride from Canby to Gresham, and he goes through and he says, "What, Canby, huh? I know the owner of the Canby McDonald's." So he called back then. Her name was Mindy Smith. Her last name has changed. He said, "Let me give Mindy a call," and he called Mindy, the owner of the Canby McDonald's, and he was more honest with her than I ever would have been in a job interview. He said, "I'm sitting here with a guy who just got out of the Oregon State Penitentiary. I told him I'd give him a job when he got out, but he lives in Canby. He doesn't have a license. If you hire him, I will vouch for him." Nobody would have ever vouched for me. But because of these men in blue and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a guy who's willing to vouch for me because of these steps and these practicing these principles in all our affairs. So she said she'd hire me, but when I get there, tell the manager to have her come and she'll fill out the paperwork. So I show up at the Canby McDonald's, and I'm greeted by this 19-year-old, smiley-faced young gal, and I'm thinking, starting to form a resentment pretty quickly about, oh my God, here I'm 44 with a bachelor's degree, and I'm gonna be, oh my God. And then it hit me, acceptance, and I'm just grateful to have a job. So she hired me, and my son would come visit, because now he's living in Spokane, and he'd come visit during summer and during holidays, and he'd come into McDonald's, and she'd be giving him ice cream for free and milkshakes and that. And my thinking was this great plan. I'll work at McDonald's for a year. And then I'm going to start putting out job applications to move on, because that way I can at least show that I've got a work history. Well, you know how I am. I started there in April. Well, New Year's came along, and a good time for a New Year's resolution, so I started putting out job applications that never got answered. They never got answered. And that didn't stop me. I kept doing it. Well, at that year mark, I get a call from Spokane, Washington, and it's my second ex-wife asking if our son could come live with me because things weren't going well for her. And I said yes, and the light came on. I got to focus on rebuilding that relationship. And you know what I found out? Was he would come into McDonald's after school, and sometimes he would be in friends. And they would sit on their little red bar stools, and they'd get ice cream and stuff from this now 20-year-old that's working. And they're loving him. And you know, and I'm sitting there at the counter one day, and my name is Ronald. And I did have red hair. And my son loved jokes. So I'm sitting up at the counter waiting on somebody, and he goes, "Hey, Ronald, where's your big red shoes?" And this person that I'm waiting on starts laughing, and that gets the rest of the people coming in laughing, and I finally realized that I couldn't have had a better job than working at McDonald's to reconnect with that son that I'd been out of his life for over 8 years than that job at McDonald's. Well, summer came around, and his mom calls and says, "Is it okay if he comes visits during summer break?" And I said, "Yeah, it's okay. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for him." While he was gone, I get this call from this drug and alcohol program, because don't you know we all want to save the world when we get sober? Well, that was me. And they said they just got my application, and I'd like to come in and interview me. And it was for a different job than I had originally put in. It wasn't a counseling job. It was what they call the milieu worker. That means I go through your clothes when you come in. I check for stuff, needles and that stuff, and do UAs on guys, and you know, check them in from passes and things like that, and pass out meds. And I said, "I'll take it." They hired me. When he got back, he was pissed off that I was no longer working at McDonald's. He got to learn how to work through resentments. And how that job went for me is, after you're there 6 months, they call you in for an interview, and the person I was working for called me in and said that they've got a C3 position. That was one step up from the one I originally applied for, and they were glad to see how I was working out, and they wanted me to apply for it. So I said, "Great." A week later, I get called back into that office, and the lady tells me there's this union thing going on, so there's a hiring freeze, but as soon as it's over, we want you to come to work here. Well, a week later, I get a call from a lady named Olga Parker, who back then was the executive deputy director of the program, and they had a women's residential program. And she said, "We need somebody to come in. I know the union thing. I know it's a step down from the one we're offering you, but you know, we need counselors. We just had a couple people quit, and we need you to come in. Would you do it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll do it." You know, and I'd done some graveyards at that place, because McDonald's had taught me about teamwork, and this book here and these guys had taught me about service work, so I'd do graveyards for greed, I mean extra money. And so I'm supposed to start on a Monday. I get a call on a Saturday night saying, "Ron, can you come in, and we need somebody, our graveyard person called and canceled. Can you come in?" I said, "Well, I just promised my son that I'd do something with him on Sunday, and if I do that, I won't be able to keep that promise." "We understand. You know how that works." 5 minutes later, "Can you work half the shift?" Teamwork, service, okay, I'll come in. So I'm in there on that Saturday night. Now it's probably Sunday morning, and I'm walking the halls, and I'm sitting there doing a little, I guess you don't want to call this prayer and meditation or personal inventory. I'm saying, "Poor me, why here? Oh God, why me, why here?" And I walk into the group room and this light comes on. My victims, a mother and two children. This was a place where they let them have their kids there. That's a place where God wanted me to be, not me. So this coming Monday, I'll be walking back in there this Monday at 7:30. Still got that same job. And what I learned about women in recovery is it's a whole lot tougher road to go than men. I mean, my stuff was my own making, my own thoughts. But a lot of terrible things happen to women when they get into, before they start using, that causes them to medicate and try to find, get rid of that pain. That was caused on them, not to by them. Mine was caused by me. And I learned that they suffer from a lot of PTSD along with their addiction. And the bad thing for a guy like me is when they're in a place together, they all PMS at the same time of the month. And it gets crazy and it gets hectic. But I'm still there. I'm still there. Good. I want to talk about one other thing before I get into another step. And that's part of making amends, too. My dad never saw me sober once I started drinking. He died on Father's Day in 1987, and he's in a hospice bed in the living room, and I go to visit him with the rest of the family because it is Father's Day and I'm still kind of under the influence, you know what I mean? And I'm holding then about an 8-month-old grandson of his, and his eyes are shut, and he opens his eyes, and he looks up at me, and he says my name, and he reaches out his hand to me. And I was too ashamed to take that hand. I said, "Here's your grandson." And his eyes closed, and 40 minutes later, he passed. And he never got to see me sober, and I have some regrets around that. Well, around the year 2000, my mother had Alzheimer's, and she asked if she could come live with me and my wife, and we said yes. So part of my job was to take, my wife was a nurse, and she stopped her job. My sister took care of the money stuff, and when I got home, it's my job. So my job early in the morning was I'd go in, I'd take her out of her bed, walk her into the bathroom, set her on the water closet, I guess you call it, commode, toilet. I'd change her diaper, I'd go in, I'd change the bedding, I'd throw it in the washer, I'd change the bed, and now this is getting late on in the time. We had hoped that she would make it to April 4th because that was her birthday, and she did. And grandkids and stuff came over, and she had this upswing, and now it's 2 weeks later, and she's barely talking, and I'm trying to feed her yogurt while she's sitting on the toilet, and she says to me, "Raymond is coming to get me to take me to my mother's house." And I thought, this is a delusional woman just talking, doesn't know what she's talking about. And those are the last words that I ever remember out of her. On August 28th, it was a Saturday, and my wife says, "You better get to your AA meeting, the Saturday breakfast meeting, because she's not going to make it through the day." So I went to that meeting, and when I came home, my mother had passed. And that night, I wasn't sleeping too well, so I went out on the couch, and I'm doing a little prayer and meditation. I said, "I've got no regrets. I've got no regrets." And then it hit me. August 28th was my grandmother, her mother's birthday. I've got to believe that my mother came to by my father, and that in so doing, he came into that house. And he saw the son that he was reaching out to. That's all because of you people and these steps that I was to be able to be the son that he had reached out to. And I've got to believe that he saw that. And today what I tell people is he walks with me and he holds my hand because I'm wearing his ring. I think I've done enough about those 12 steps. I'd like to talk about one other step that doesn't get talked out about. Some of you are laughing, so you know it's the 13th step, right? Well, when I got out, they wanted me to sign in that parole thing, that aftercare plan, that I would not get into a relationship for 1 year. And I said, "Evidently, you can't do the math. It's not in this book anywhere. Show me." Unless somebody wrote it in there. But February 13th. 89, March 30th, 96. Those numbers just don't add up to me. So we went over it, and we went over it, and I agreed to do that crazy thing, 90 meetings in 90 days. I won't get into a relationship for the first 90 days I get out. Now, I've got to tell you, I'm not saying that I didn't do any visual 13-stepping in my head. I got to be totally honest. But then I remember as I'm going into those meetings and, you know, doing that, there's some pretty sick women in here. And I remember seeing while I was locked up, they had this movie called Fatal Attraction. And then I'm thinking, who in their right mind would get in a relationship with me? I just got out of prison. I know there's some sick women that think, oh, there's some benefits to that, I guess, after 8 years. And then I'm sitting there thinking, I'm working at McDonald's. I don't have a driver's license. I don't have a car. I'm living at my mother's house. What am I going to do, take you out for a Happy Meal? And I know there's a lot of sick women here. And then I thought a little deeper, because doing that sexual inventory in step four that... You didn't do it, did you, Jason? No. Nobody does, Jimmy. No. And I'm sitting there. My thinking then was, well, if I get in a relationship with one of these women with my track record, it ain't going to work out. It just ain't going to work out. You know, and am I going to actually be able to share openly and honestly in a meeting with her next to me? No way. No way. And then I thought, I'm going to have to stop going to meetings once we split up, and I'm not going to be able to share, and I'm screwed. And then that sexual inventory hit me a little harder. What about her? What about her? It ain't got nothing to do with me anymore. It's what about her? In this thing here, it says, we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Here's when the spiritual awakening, I hear, takes place. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. So what I've got to tell you is my wife, you'll see her around once in a while here today. She's with our dog. We're going on 21 years of marriage. Now that's a miracle. I want to close with one last letter. I don't have time to go into why I didn't get this letter until around Easter of the year 2000, but it's dated July 25th, 1994, Gary Kay's sobriety day. Dear Ron, we appreciate your sincere letter and are pleased to know that we have made that you have made tremendous progress in rehabilitation. Great. Keep up the good work. Keep up the good work. I really didn't realize how in depth you had gone to turn your life around. When I was in that hearing there, listening to your achievements, I thought, oh great, I'm going to kick someone that's down. I almost didn't read my letter. My greatest concern, and the reason I even went to the hearing, was to be completely satisfied that my remaining family would be safe upon your release. It was good for me to attend the hearing, for now I am confident regarding this issue. Trudy would never hold a grudge or have anything to do with bitterness. I just have to remind myself and think about what she would want me to do. At that parole board hearing, Ron, is when I forgave you. And now I want to say, I forgive you, and she underlined that part. I thought that after you served your time, you would be out footloose and fancy free, never again remembering or thinking about what you did. But I now realize that you too will be having to deal with this the rest of your life. In closing, I just want to say that Trudy was a very spiritual young woman praying on a regular basis. So I know she is with our Lord, and someday I will see her again. God bless you and your family, Helen. Now, the reason I'm reading this is because this extends beyond these men in blue to each and every one of you. P.S. Ron, please share this letter with your AA group. Let them know I appreciate the thank you and that each one of you are in my thoughts and prayers for a full and productive life. There's people praying out for you that you don't even know. And I want to thank each and every one of you for 12-stepping me one more time so that I can keep that promise. Because if you're an alcoholic like me, you know I can't do this on my own. No matter what. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ron.